Blog Talk Radio.
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America here on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Good Sunday evening for August 21st, 2022. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, and here to talk with you about the big events in pro wrestling. So a lot going on in wrestling. It's a little bit the calm before the storm next month with the big clash at the Castle Show, and then we have AEW All Out, which we'll be previewing next week here on Wrestling Night in America. But tonight, we will touch on AEW, some of the controversies coming out of this week's set of shows. We'll talk a little bit about WWE. Got a couple email questions about WWE that we'll get to. And if you'd like to email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com is where you can send those emails. And you can call us up, 515-605-9345. Press 1 to show up in the queue. Otherwise, you can just hang on the line and listen. So we'll talk AEW. We'll talk WWE. We're going to talk New Japan, because the G1 finished up this week, and to help run through the G1 with me is PWTorch.com contributor and New Japan specialist Javier Machado. Javier, welcome back to Wrestling Night in America tonight.
Hey, Greg, how's it going? Always great to talk to you, man. You're so much nicer than Wade.
We'll edit that part out. He won't have to hear that. But thank you. you know, the G1 is, in years past, it's been something that I've caught here and there. This year I was able to catch all of the shows, the full shows, including the tags. Yes. So
you're a better man than me.
I was going to say, we are few and far between, but I feel a certain camaraderie with the people who made it through the G1, including the tag matches, because it certainly is not always worth it. But, you know, I am a completist. I feel like if I'm going to watch it, I have to watch the whole thing. So that explains it. But to kind of set the stage for people who may not be caught up on the G1 and have maybe only a peripheral knowledge of New Japan, Kazuchika Okada won his second G1 in a row. He defeated Will Ospreay in the finals. The semifinals saw Okada defeat Tama Tonga and Ospreay defeat Tetsuya Naito. The A-block winner was Okada with 10 points. Jonah came in second with 8. In the B-block, it was a tie. Tonga and White both had 10 points. Tonga had the tiebreaker, however. In the C-block, it was a tie there. Naito and Zack Sabre Jr. with Naito owning the tiebreaker. And then in the D-block, Will Ospreay had 5 others were tied with 6 points. So let me first ask you about Okada winning, because, you know, second win in a row, I always look at the G1 very similarly that I look at the Royal Rumble, where it's a real opportunity to elevate someone who can be a potential major star for the next year. And more often than not, just like WWE, New Japan tends to have an established star like an Okada win the tournament. First of all, just kind of what your impression of the decision to have Okada win this one?
I kind of agree with it, because now that things are finally returning, more back to normal in Japan, as a helicopter flies overhead, distracting me, it makes sense that you get Okada involved in the top stuff. He is your top draw. The only one I think that would come in close might be Kota Ibushi, but that's a whole different story. So it makes sense that he's going to be, he's going to be the next one. Cause I mean, they did, I think their best, you know, some of their best business when he was at the top and he had that awesome long run. I don't think he's going to have like a run on that level, but they do need to like pretty much reestablish that the world heavyweight title. And I think like giving him a run would do it, or even not giving him a run and having him go after it and then failing. But I think that might be one of the things that they're thinking of.
How much of this was a business decision? I mean, you mentioned New Japan kind of going back to normal. We heard about the announcers that there's going to be some sections at the next big show where you know, you will be able to, I mean, you know, for those who don't know, Japan is still masked up in the buildings. They're not allowing, I mean, it's clapping only, I think, at this point still, and stomping of the feet, I assume. But the next tour, they're in some places, they're going to allow sections where fans will be able to be a little more vocal. You know, we've seen attendance down partially because of that. New Japan does not feel like it's a hot product. Is this a business decision by New Japan to say, hey, you know, we're kind of taking baby steps to return back to normal, and we want you to know you haven't missed anything. Okada is still on top. He was your favorite when New Japan was hot on top, and, you know, he's back in that same position. Is that a sort of business decision by New Japan going forward with things maybe looking closer to normal, potentially? I know there's a lot of caveats there, but in Japan over the next few months?
Yeah, I think so. Particularly since he has a couple of rivals now that he didn't have previously, because Will Ospreay has turned, particularly with the performance in the finals, he's basically positioned himself as like an ongoing rival. He's going to be to Okada what Okada was to Tanahashi, has always been my feeling between Ospreay and Okada. So I think that is what they're kind of more building up to. Plus, you also have Okada and Jay White. You know, that's something that could go on for quite a bit. So he does have like a different group of people to work with, because beforehand, the main nexus of his group was Naito, Tanahashi, and I'm blanking, Suzuki. He ran into Suzuki a few times and you know, yeah, Kenny Omega and stuff. But that was the people like before. If he gets a run now, he has an entire different set of people to work with. And now it's going to be more, you know, before he was invincible. And if you watch really closely his matches, he is more in danger in his matches and is basically, you know, grabbing victory out of the jaws of defeat more often than he had previously. So giving you a feel that, you know, that the talent that's coming in, the talent that's growing up, is catching up to him. So I think it's going to be interesting to give him like a second, like long run. Like I said, not as long as the previous one, but, you know, have him be the one that other people are gunning for. It, a little bit different from his first run, which where he was just like the man. And now it's like he's the man, but, you know, for how long?
Yeah, getting by almost as much on guile as, you know, the skill that a younger Okada got by on. One guy who stands out to me from this tournament, if you look at the final four, you look at Okada, okay, that makes sense. Ospreay, yeah, of course. Naito, yeah, I see that. Tama Tonga, he seemed to be the sore thumb that stuck out amongst those four final four names. And, you know, getting by in a block that had Jay White, who was undefeated for a long stretch in this G1, is an accomplishment. So what do you make of Tama Tonga? Where do you see his push in the next year? Obviously, you know, Gedo doesn't do anything accidentally in his booking, you know. So to put Tonga in this position, and by the way, chiseled Tonga. I mean, he's got an impressive specimen. Physical specimen. And so, you know, he's obviously taken this singles push seriously. So where do you see him in the next year in New Japan? How does he fit in amongst some of these top names who he rubbed elbows with in this tournament?
Well, I've always been a fan of Tama Tonga, not only because he looks awesome, he has like this incredible charisma, but also the way that he moves differently in the ring. He moves kind of like more like a cat or like a snake, you know, the way that he maneuvers around the, you know, he commands the ring. It's a different style, which is, you know, very unique to him. So he, my understanding, he's become more of a fan favorite in Japan. So they turned him face, and he's been on a journey. Cause I mean, that's the thing. If you're following his journey from, I think it was last year one, he had this match with, in the last year one, I'm pretty sure he cut off all the cheating. And then he had this match with Tanahashi, which I think is like the beginning of the whole thing. He had this match with Tanahashi, which was great. And it was a fair match. It was all fair play, one-on-one. He almost beat Tanahashi, ends up losing. And as a result of that match, he actually ends up taking the Tanahashi's finisher, the High Fly Flow, and redubbed it the Supreme Flow. And then that culminated with him beating Okada. And, you know, that then became the, you know, he got kicked, him and his brother got kicked out of Bullet Club, Tangaloa, along with Jado. And it's been, you know, then he had to redeem himself in the eyes of what's called Hantai, which is the non-affiliated, basically your babyface group in New Japan. And then, you know, and this was the culmination of that storyline. So it's been, you know, the idea being to build him up. I don't think he's going to be like on the level of an Okada, Ibushi, Naito, you know, one of those top guys. But if you build him strong enough to get basically a lower level, you know, he's going to be in a lower level card. I think they're trying to get him into the same like area where you see a Sonata, a Taichi, Zack Sabre Jr., those guys that are usually going to be like your upper middle level guys. You're, you know, kind of like your gatekeepers of occasional challenge for the title. I think that's what they're trying to do, obviously by giving a hard push now. And then, you know, you kind of cool him off a little bit and he'll land where he's supposed to land.
Yeah. He was impressive here. And I'm glad you sort of ran down the Tama Tonga journey, because I think that's important to understand where he is now and where he's going to be going over the next year or so. A lot of newcomers in
it's one of why he's one of the final four, because now that you have four different block winners, one of those spots can be used to help elevate somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that he beat Jay White, who they currently have a rivalry going to, I'm assuming is also going to set up an actual title shot where Jay White will get back his win, and then things will settle down for Tama.
Yeah. So a lot of newcomers in this one. You know, we had Jonah, we had Tom Lawler, we had some others. What newcomer, or maybe someone who is not a usual New Japan main eventer, who impressed you the most throughout this tournament?
Of the people who I felt were most elevated, their first or one of their few tournaments. Was this David Finley's first or second one? David Finley definitely was they really established him during this. Someone who only had one win, which Aaron Hernari, but he looked good in the stuff that he was doing. I don't think he's completely finished, but he looks like he's coming, you know, if he could just tie everything together, he could be, you know, it's the first time I've been really impressed with him outside of the World Tag League he tagged with Tanahashi. So he's coming together. Lawler is a weird case because I really liked Lawler on Strong, but the way they presented him was really odd, and I never got the feel. I mean, granted, there's, you know, the crowd can't make noise, but it felt more like the crowd was respectful than they were really in on him. So he had that one match against Okada, which was really good. It was probably one of my favorite matches of that block that really felt like this to establish Tom Lawler. But I thought that should have really come in earlier in the tournament to establish him earlier, because throughout most of the tournament, it felt like I said, it felt more like there were, you know, more polite than anything else. And then he beats Jeff Cobb right after that. So I kind of don't think that worked, you know, like had that happened earlier and you established him to the crowd in that kind of form, like he's a serious wrestler, because the early stuff, he kind of felt almost like a Yano kind of, you know, more of a comedy.
Yeah.
Lower
That's
level
the name I was thinking of.
Guy. Yeah. So that was kind of the thing with him, which is, you know, a shame because I really liked him. And if you just look at the Cobb and Okada matches in isolation, I thought those were great. But, you know, when you add everything else that happened, I don't think this was the best showing for him. And who else? Let me take a quick look at the list of the I think they tried to really push Chase Owens. I don't think it really, you know, took. You know what I mean? He was one that felt like this tournament was designed to elevate, and I mean, he's better than he was before. And I think bring up Great O'Khan. Great O'Khan, they did that to him last. They pushed him last year. This felt more like we just needed a body this time, and this is going to be his you know, like sophomore slump kind of deal. Although he had a good showing against Jay White to show what he can do. And yeah, I mean, and then there's El Fantasmo is another one, but he only really had that one big victory at the end of the tournament. Although he had a great match against Juice Robinson that I liked a lot. But I think that pretty much covers the. Oh, Jonah. Duh. I'm sorry. The thing about Jonah, I know that people got really hyped, but I just had a feeling that they're setting up Jonah just to be the next monster for Okada to kill. And sure enough, and he's going to be one of the two people that Okada's going to defend the briefcase against, or at least two, one, you know, at least one of the two people that he's going to defend the right to challenge contract. So, you know, and it is what it is. But you know, that was, you know, so that's why a lot of people were like really excited for the Jonah beating Okada during the thing. I'm like, it's a means to an end, and yeah, it's cool, and I liked it, but I was a little bit less hyped for that.
Yeah, a couple comments on some of the guys you brought up. You know, Tom Lawler. I liked, you know, if it was anybody but Tom Lawler, I guess, and maybe it, you know, it worked because of his humor. But like the DVD trade off he tried to do with Yano. I mean, that Sister Act, I think, was the Sister Act 2, maybe even was the DVD. Yeah. You know, that was funny, but like, I haven't seen a lot of Tom Lawler. You know, I've seen some of him in MLW. But, you know, I've heard about him and his skills and his submission work, and it almost kind of felt like a letdown because it was more Yano-ish, and, you know, especially in the tags. And maybe maybe that is clouding my memory of his singles matches, but I just felt like they didn't really fully take advantage of everything Lawler could bring to the table. So that was kind of disappointing because I was kind of hyped to see him in this environment. Dave Finley, and I always tell the story about Dave Finley. I think the first year I actually sat down and watched the G1, including like getting up and watching them live, he was one of the young boys with Jay White in those undercard matches. And so to see those two come from that to where they are today is fascinating. And yeah, Finley was not a guy I was expecting to get the kind of push that he did get in this tournament with some big wins. So I thought that was really cool. Chase Owens, he's a guy who a couple years ago, I remember watching the G1, and I remember tweeting at Greg M. Parks, and I was like, I just don't, like, Chase Owens doesn't do anything for me. I don't get the appeal. And he tweeted back, and he was like, hey, that's okay, man. Like, you know, it was kind of like, you know, whatever. And so, like, I'm ready to fully admit today that I was actually – you know, this was the most impressed that I had been with Chase Owens in this tournament. He felt serious. He felt like, you know, he looked good cosmetically. I mean, you talk about Tama Tonga being in shape. Chase Owens looked to be in good shape. And so, you know, I'll give credit where credit's due. He looked good, and he impressed me in a couple of these big matches. So I'll tip my hat to him there. But, yeah, a lot of interesting talking points coming out of this for – you know, even the guys who didn't even make the top two or three got some big wins and something to, you know, take home and talk about. So you mentioned earlier the four blocks, and that's, you know, Tama Tonga in a normal year may not have been in this position, pushed to this level. This is the first year with four blocks. Previously, they've done two blocks. So how do you think – now that we've seen the entirety of the tournament play out, how do you think the four blocks worked versus the two blocks, and would you like to see the four blocks return next year?
Okay, I'm of two minds on that, on a lot of things. But at first, when the tournament first started, I was really negative on it. I'm kind of like a mathy guy, and I liked at the end of the night to be able to look and see where everybody's at. And then during this tournament, you had points where one wrestler had wrestled three times and one wrestler only wrestled once in the same block. Because what they were doing is, for the most part, to start with, for the people who didn't follow, they would have four block matches, one for each block. And then there were times where they would have five. And then I think on the next last night, they had 8. So it was never kind of like even. So it was hard to, for someone, you know, to like track, and you kind of didn't really get the momentum of where each wrestler stood in terms of like who was in ahead and who's behind, you know, around the middle of time, you know, the middle of thing. Plus there's another thing that, and this is, I know this is me being, not a great human being, but I liked the idea of, you know, one of the things that drew me in was the attrition in an actual G1 when you had the two blocks where, you know, you had these wrestlers wrestling high-level matches three, four times a week, and you felt that exhaustion. And that was part of what was a strong draw to me was like, you know, wow, these are like, you know, they're really putting on their all. And it felt like going above and beyond anything you see anywhere else, you know. And that's what I'm saying. I'm being not a good human being, because, you know, obviously this is not going to be great for your health, for the rest of hell. But, you know, that aside, if I'm just going to be completely selfish, that was a selfish thing, you know, for me. But, you know, it really pulled together towards, you know, the middle. And then, you know, so, and then I started enjoying it and following more the individual, since I didn't have the whole tournament to kind of follow as like the story of the tournament, because it was too hard to follow the overall arc. Start paying closer attention to the individual story arcs with the different wrestlers. So I still got enjoyment out of that. In any case, you did have a couple nights though that were just, you know, normally you would always have like, you know, at least one really good match every night. There were a couple nights where it was like pretty not, you know, it was pretty brutal to watch the episode, yeah. The show. So there were a couple that were like really, you know, not the best of cards.
And I totally get why they did it, and you hit the nail on the head with the big reason, which is it saves the wear and tear on these guys. They're wrestling fewer matches. That's important, especially when a lot of the talent that's being used year after year in this tournament is getting older, and they're getting more wear and tear on their bodies. You know, if four blocks will save Okada an extra year to doing the G1, I think, you know, they should do it. And I think the other upside is what you mentioned earlier, you know, Tama Tonga getting the opportunity to wrestle in the semifinals, getting the opportunity to win a block, something that he may not have had the opportunity to do had it been, you know, only two blocks. So I think it does make for more opportunities for certain wrestlers who wouldn't otherwise get these chances. So I was pretty positive on it throughout. What did you see coming out of this? I know they set up, it seemed like the last night in some of the tag matches, but what did you see set up for future directions? I know you talked a little bit about Okada and who he might be defending the briefcase against over the next few months, but did you see any other directions set up either on that last night in the tag matches or throughout the tournament, anything that you can see, you know, within the next few months taking place?
Yeah, you have for the IWGP World Heavyweight Championship, you have Tama Tonga as a likely contender for that, considering he pinned Jay White, and he also has a big victory over Okada previous year, so he has a stake to the championships. I'm expecting to see that. For the IWGP United States Heavyweight Championship, they've already pretty much said that that Ospreay is wrestling David Finlay. But also Juice Robinson, Shingo, and Archer have all made claims to the title. So I'm assuming that Ospreay is going to be a busy boy defending that title. The IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championship, currently in possession of Taiji Ishimori. Kushida rolled up and Kushida, when he returned to New Japan, said that he wanted a shot at the title. Ishimori said, "Oh, you know, just because you come back, I ran you out of the company. Just because you're coming back now, you don't get that shot, and you got to prove it." And then he proved it on the final night by rolling him up and getting a pin on Ishimori. You know, because Ishimori asked for it. The Never Open Weight title, Tanahashi got a pinfall victory on the final night against Carl Anderson, and then you know, pointed at his waist, so he's going after the Never. Then you have the IWGP Tag Team Champions. That's in the hands of FTR, so who the hell knows what's going to happen there. Same thing with the Junior Heavyweight. That's in the hands of Francesco, Akira, and TJP over on Strong, so that's being dealt with over there. I'm expecting the never open six-man tags to probably end up being currently in Goto, Yo, and Yoshihashi's probably going to be another House of Torture, you know, some permutation of the House of Torture would be my guess. And then the last of the titles, quote-unquote, is the King of Pro Wrestling trophy, which is currently in possession of Shingo. They're setting up something with ELP, and what's I'm assuming is probably a Who's Your Daddy match. So that's been a theme of El Fantasmo. El Fantasmo pinned Shingo on the last time on his last match for the Block tournament, and has been teasing Shingo and getting under Shingo's skin with that. And they also seem to be teasing something between Zack Sabre Jr. And Tom Lawler too, which seemed interesting. There's something going on between Toriano and Doc Gallows. It might be for the Impact World Tag Team Champions, which Doc Gallows and Carl Anderson hold. And the briefcase defenses, which is Jonah has the win over Okada, so he has a claim at the briefcase. And Okada asked Naito to challenge him for it because Naito would be the one block winner that Okada did not defeat during the tournament. So that's pretty much the wraps up the stuff I think that's coming up.
Nice. Final question on the G1 before we go to the phones. Tournament MVP. If you had to award an MVP for this tournament, who would it be?
That was a hard one because I actually rank all the matches and put the stars, and then like at the end I let the algorithm tell me who the MVP was, and then I'll agree or disagree. But because that's one of the problems with the four blocks, though, is that when you have four blocks, you're going to have – normally you would have like Yano in one block and Yujiro in the other one, and they would kind of serve to drag their individual blocks down. Or Fale, particularly, because I do give Deano high matches because I like comedy wrestling. But usually, like, Fale in one and Yujiro in the other one, they drag it down. But because you have four blocks, some of the blocks were dragged down by those two while the other two blocks were higher. So I actually ended up with Kenta. I ended up ranking Kenta as the highest one. I thought Kenta had a really good one. It seemed like he had something to prove. He was really engaged in the more important matches. And he had the best average match. I have to give it to, and by the way, this does not include the final two nights. I'm only talking about Block because if you add the final two nights, it's Ospreay. But I did give Ospreay just Block wise. I gave him the slight edge. He had great matches with Shingo, Shingo and Finley. So I gave a slight edge to Ospreay as far as just the Block. But then that final match between Okada and Ospreay, particularly if you watched the promo stuff in the semifinals that set up the finals by Ospreay, that was, you know, I think that was match of the year for me so far.
Yeah, it's not a controversial pick. It's not a, you know, off-the-wall pick. It's not a hot take pick, but Ospreay would be my MVP, I think, from having watched that. So yeah, we're on a very similar wavelengths to that, I think, on this one. So just to kind of reset here at the bottom of the hour, I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, being joined by PWTorch.com contributor Javier Machado. This is Wrestling Night in America for August 21st, 2022. If you'd like to send us an email for a topic to talk about, WNIALivecast@gmail.com. You can also reach us by phone, live on the air. You can talk to us. 515-605-9345 is the number to call. So let's go to our first phone call of the night. It is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland. Ryan, welcome to Wrestling Night in America. What's your first question for us tonight?
Okay, my first question is, I attended AEW in Charleston. I just have a few questions, see if you can answer them. First question is on the Kenny Omega promo. I don't know if you heard about it. I guess it wasn't on the air. Pretty much blamed the fans for his injuries and said that the only type of match he can do right now is tag team matches because of the extent of his injuries. So my question is, did they delay this tournament just for Kenny to come back and be able to do these types of matches?
That had always been the report, and it may have even been confirmed by Tony Khan in one of the many, many interviews that he does. I don't know where he gets the time between all of his responsibilities to even do interviews, but he does a lot of them. And so the thinking was, you know, Kenny Omega was going to be a big part, not only in the matches, but in the story, as we've seen develop already, just in the early goings of the Trios tournament. And, you know, he's going to be so integral in those stories being told with, you know, the Young Bucks and Adam Cole and Adam Page and all of them, that they were going to wait and do the Trios tournament. And there really was no rush, Javier, to do the Trios tournament because they were constantly introducing new titles anyway. So it's not like there was ever a good time to, like, you know, you didn't want to introduce the Trios title tournament a week after you introduced the, you know, the Owen Hart Memorial Tournament, or, you know, the latest title, the North America, the North Atlantic title. You didn't want to do it at the same time you were doing that. So you may have had to rearrange. Maybe you planned on doing the Trios tournament earlier and maybe the North Atlantic tournament later. You just maybe swapped them. But I do think it was important for storytelling purposes more than anything else to wait until Omega was ready, Javier. Is that kind of the sense you get as well?
Well, with the talk right now on TV with Kenny Omega talking about injuries, or not necessarily on TV because that was to the audience, and the story of the match, I really think that the whole injury thing is overblown. That's a work. I'm 85% sure that part of it is a work. The idea is, you know, have them involved, have them likely win it, and essentially elevate and establish the six-man titles, trios titles. Wow, how did I make that mistake? The trios titles.
I don't know. They are completely different, Javier. I don't know how you could possibly make this mistake.
Yeah, no. But yeah, I think the idea is to elevate that. And I mentioned this on the AEW post show that I think the idea is you're going to end up, the injuries are going to end up writing Kenny Omega out again. I felt a little bit more confident when I before I found out that the AEW game is not coming out until 2023, but he's likely going to be involved in the launch of that. So I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up leaving at some point. And this all be a work for him to, like, you know, for him to basically say, oh yeah, you know, look how injured he is. He gets taken out, and then Hangman Page has to end up taking Kenny Omega's spot. I think that's very likely a thing they might end up doing. But yeah, I mean, they're overselling. I think they overplayed their hands with him missing the "You Can't Escape" and some of the stuff that they were doing, and how over the top the commentary was, and like, oh, he doesn't look like he's back fully, and oh my God, look at that. You know, it felt like too much play acting for it to be, you know, as not to take it as serious as they're trying to portray it.
Yeah. All right, Ryan, back to you for your second question for us.
My second question. I don't know if this came off like it did live, but there was a spot in that six-man tag team match with Kenny and the Bucks. I believe it was Kenny went flying right over, like, the guardrail, like the opponent was on the guardrail, and he took him out with a wild dive, and there was a young kid, like, a few feet away. So how did they, like, handle, like, this, like, safety precautions? Did they give, like, kids the let that kid know in advance what's happening? Did they give him some, like, advice on how to avoid injury? Because it seemed odd, you know, that, you know, they would put that kid in that type of situation.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never sat that close to, you know, I've never had front row seats to know what exactly the protocol is. I know sometimes, you know, you'll see people back away, so I don't know if they were warned ahead of time. You know, usually they try to have security there to kind of back people away. But if they don't, you know, Javier, I don't really know. I think you are taking a big risk if you're AEW, but, you know, hopefully there are protocols in place that, you know, keep people safe when they do go into the crowd like that.
I would think so, but they're kind of a little bit more fly by the seat of your pants kind of thing. and yeah, I think the moment was Kenny Omega was on the guardrail, and it was Dragon Lee trying to, you know, end himself by doing something completely, totally crazy. So I think that was the spot. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point, if they continue doing spots like that, someone does end up getting hurt, and then they would have to, you know, come up with a protocol at that point. Similar to go back to when Matt Hardy did the ill-advised and the ill physics of him jumping off of that scissor lift, and you know, got hurt, and then like they continued the match, and you know they had to institute protocol after that when everybody, you know, when like, oh, we shouldn't have done that. I'm expecting that to, you know, most likely someone's going to get hurt, and then that's when we're going to find out what they're going to do.
Man. Take him backstage, give him a handshake and a picture with the with Hangman. That's protocol, maybe. I don't know.
you should, that, I mean, you know, soothe some people, but yeah.
Yeah. All right, Ryan, your final question for us tonight.
Yeah, I just want to confirm, yeah, Javier is right on that was the spot. And my final question is, before I went into that arena, the Coliseum in Charleston, I saw an ambulance out there with its lights on. So I didn't know if you heard any reports that there was a wrestler that had to go in the ambulance, or maybe it was one of the fans that was out there all day with the title belt, you know, just hanging out in the heat, and they got like a heat stroke or some sort of medical, like dehydrated out there. But what do you think was going on with that ambulance? Did you hear any reports on that?
I did not hear any reports. Sometimes that I don't know. I assume that sometimes they have their lights on for non-medical emergency-related situations. So that could be the situation here, Javier. I don't know if you heard anything about any kind of emergencies before Dynamite Wednesday night.
No, I mean, you could always have, like, I mean, you have a lot of people there, so somebody could be suffering from heat stroke or you know, cardiac event or something. I mean, it's something that could happen,
yeah.
But you're not going to hear that unless there's something in, like, really, or, I mean, even a fainting spell. You know, I'm in South Florida, you get a lot of, you know, I go to a lot of, like, stores there in, near the beach, and there's always a ambulance out there because, you know, older person just had a fainting spell or, you know, dizzy spell, and you know, they need to make sure that they act with alacrity just in case things are bad. They don't get, you know, and they don't get in trouble.
Right. Yeah. All right. Ryan, thanks for the phone call, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, I agree with Javier. There were over 4,000 people there, so that makes a little bit of sense. But
yeah.
Thanks for taking the call.
All right. Sure thing. Let's stay on AEW because there's a lot of discussion this week about AEW and not all about the Trios tournament and the return of Kenny Omega. CM Punk's promo. He returned the previous week. He cut a promo this week and actually set up a match with Jon Moxley next week on Dynamite. So not saving it, at least for now, for All Out. And Punk, in the beginning of his promo, called out Adam Page. There is some reporting out there that went against the script and was something that was not expected to be done, and that Punk potentially went into business for himself there. The following days was met by reports from Dave Meltzer that there's a lot of main event unhappiness in AEW. So, you know, there's a couple ways to attack this, Javier. The first is CM Punk, and you know, we saw with the MJF stuff that, and we still don't really know what parts are worked and what parts are shoot. We know that at least part of it was worked because he came out on Dynamite and cut a promo and, you know, whatever like that. That was a worked shoot type promo, but we don't know how much of that was influenced by an actual real life event. So here we are again with something on screen or you know, backstage unhappiness being brought out into the open on television. So my first question to you is just how much of this is work and how much of it is shoot, do you think, with what's going on with CM Punk right now?
Well, with the Hangman Page, that feels like shoot because I found that opening segment of what he talked about Hangman Page, that felt almost dirty, almost like, you know, that he did Hangman Page dirty because here they are in West Virginia, which is I know Hangman Page is from like the opposite side of West Virginia, I think from where they were, but essentially his home state, and he is calling out Hangman Page, and you know, saying, hey, you know, you were whining about not getting a rematch, which is, you know, a legit thing to complain about if you lose your title and don't get a rematch. So he goes, oh, I'm going to give you the rematch right now. And then, like, that makes Punk look small because it's like, well, you know, does he know he's not there? Is that why he's saying it? And if you know, Hangman Page really there, then Hangman Page is looking small. And if you are in the know, or, you know, like someone listens to these kinds of podcasts, you know, you're whether you know directly or not, instinctually, you know that AEW books their segments separately, and there's not much bleed over in storyline wise. And Hangman Page is involved in the trio stuff, so you know that he's not going to all of a sudden jump over to start a feud with CM Punk while he's involved in that. So it just made Hangman Page look really bad, but him calling out and him not coming out. And from what I heard reported that Hangman Page was actually there, they might have had to scrap whatever he was doing, because then you can't have Hangman Page come out and cut a promo or have him be involved in a backstage segment or have him, you know, be involved in a, you know, something out, because then you're saying, oh, he was here, yet he didn't come out. So
I think John Silver posted a photo of Adam Cole in catering. I think he posted that on Twitter, and I think some people are using that to show that it was not a shoot, that it was a work. That, you know, obviously it was a shoot, you would think that they would be mad about it and they wouldn't have that picture ready to be shown or anything like that. So, yeah, you're right. It did seem like he was there, but yeah, it's an interesting situation, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so it definitely feels, and you know, if for the people who haven't read the, you know, it was reported by, I think, of the Observer that a lot of this stems from issues with between, you know, going all the way back to the CM Punk, Cole Commander stuff, and that seems to be like what's driving the divide and the animosity between, you know, part of the roster and CM Punk. So I think a lot of that is shoot and. You know, whether they turn into work or not, we'll find out.
What did you think of the promo battle, as it were, between Punk and Moxley on Wednesday? We know that, you know, for situations like this, you don't have to have a 100% heel. You don't have to have a 100% babyface. You know, Jon Moxley is kind of a Shades of Grey character in and of himself, and Punk is... You know, we saw him with the Adam Page stuff earlier that he was willing to be a little rough on Page. So, what were your impressions of that promo battle? Did you think one of them outperformed the other, and then maybe got in more zingers? And who do you see as playing more of the heel and more of the babyface in this?
Well, word of warning, I am not a CM Punk fan.
Okay.
I've tried really hard to disassociate my feelings about him from, you know, how I analyze things. But there were several things I did not like, because granted, if the idea is that he's going to be like a scumbag heel, and this is like some of the earliest signs of this, then okay, good. That's fine. But I mean, he goes off and starts talking about how he's not willing to test himself against his best friend, Eddie Kingston, right? And then goes on to demean Eddie Kingston, who is one of the top baby faces in the company right now, one of the more beloved, you know, wrestlers by the fans. So he takes shots at Eddie Kingston and says that he's not willing to test him against Eddie Kingston. However, you know, this makes Punk look bad, because Eddie Kingston wrestled you know, they had a feud when the first time that Moxley had the title, back in Full Gear, I think, Full Gear 2020, and they had an I Quit match. So they've already have had their encounter over the titles. He's already tested against him. Not only that, they're telling, you know, saying, oh, you're not so willing to test yourself against people. He did not join the Blackpool Combat Club until he tested himself against Daniel Bryan, or tested Daniel Bryan. Same thing with Yuta. He almost killed Yuta three times. Daniel Garcia was probably going to end up joining him. He's already beaten him two times. So, I mean, that struck a false chord. And then I thought was disrespectful to Moxley's gimmick is him doing snow angels in the ring, saying, oh, you know, oh, it's going to take forever to get here. I'm just going to do some snow angels. Snow angels, that's completely dismissive. And when Moxley was talking, well, he was in the middle of a line, and in the middle of the line, CM Punk interrupts him to drop a snide comment, forcing, you know, Moxley to, you know, readjust. And I'm watching that, and I'm knowing Moxley's character, like he at that point he should just drop the mic and just gone after him at that point and screw the rest of, like, because he still had like 5 more minutes of stuff to talk about and just gone for the attack right there. It just felt like there was a lot of stuff that CM Punk did that was not really helping move the storyline along and more serving to get himself over than to help get himself and his opponent over. That was kind of my takeaway from that.
It was fascinating, if nothing else. You know, the whole, character arc of CM Punk and what he is in AEW. I mean, if he ever does turn fully heel, and I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case, I mean, think about the arc from his return in Chicago. And, I mean, the fan with the tears coming down their eyes, coming down their face in the crowd, and then to turn heel. I mean, it is an interesting character arc. And, you know, it's always fun, you know, the shots at Eddie Kingston about not being the best, you know, being the third best Eddie and the second best Kingston. I mean, you get a cheap chuckle out of it, if nothing else. So I guess that's, you know, it's the continuing the WWE references and things like that, which I know a lot of people don't like for as much as AEW goes to that well. But, you know, I thought the barbs were pretty sharp from both guys, which is what you expect from a promo battle between CM Punk and Jon Moxley. And it served to set up next week's title match, interim champion Jon Moxley against AEW champion CM Punk. So that was unexpected. I think a lot of people looked at Punk versus Moxley as a worthy all-out main event. And it still could be. We could have a situation next week where there is some kind of unsatisfying finish that leads to a rematch at the pay-per-view. Perhaps a way to get the interim title out of the way and just have, you know, Punk's title on the line in a rematch at All Out. But ultimately, I mean, what do you make of the decision to do the title match next week on Dynamite? And do you think there's a chance we could see Moxley versus Punk again in some form, maybe with a stipulation attached, at All Out?
I hope that the thing is exactly what you just said, that it's to force a stipulation for All Out. That makes sense. Probably another bloody, you know, lights out match or something along those lines. That's what I'm hoping for. Because my fear is, you know, I imagine another parallel universe where CM Punk never broke his foot and stayed as the champion, and then MJF came in and the two of them basically start working a program that pays off at All Out. And knowing how we've already seen Tony Khan basically say, this is the result I want, and then things happen, but we're still going to get to that result without adjusting it. You know, the biggest worry is that CM Punk wins and out comes MJF, and then it's going to be MJF and CM Punk for all out with only like 1 week to really, you know, promote the stuff. So that, you know, I can see a universe where that might end up happening. I really hope not, because that would be dumb. But and I am hoping that this is just to get some sort of stipulation from the pay per view.
Speaking of MJF, what is your, if not a return to face title, where do you see him coming back, if at all? I mean, do you have a prediction for when he might return to AEW TV?
If not on Wednesday, I think at All Out would be okay. what I would think.
Awesome. Well, that would certainly add another dimension to things, a returning MJF. So, that's as good a take as any there. So,
what would be interesting is if this sets up a face MJF versus a heel Punk. So that was brought up on the AEW Pro Show, and I'm like, yeah, I could probably get behind that.
That, oh boy, the dynamics there would certainly be interesting as well. Let's go back to the phones. We have the 305 area code. It's DJ from Miami. DJ, welcome to Wrestling Night in America tonight. What's on your mind?
You guys were just talking about the Punk thing. I want to start with that. I feel like it's he said, she said, whatever. Look, tell me right now, when's the last time y'all seen this guy wrestle? I haven't. Okay? He's been in the Dork Order for how many years? 2 years? And what has he done? Nothing. He's a great talker. I haven't seen him do nothing. Okay? So guess what? If he goes to ROH, who cares? He hasn't done anything for this company. CM Punk didn't do this. He did this to himself. It's just like, dude, you know, and then they're like beefing because of who's friends with friends, dude. Like, come on, dude. And that, or
well,
let me ask you another.
I think the one thing, you know, DJ, the one thing you have to keep in mind, though, is there is a life behind the camera. And, you know, Colt Cabana is a guy who seems to be universally well-liked by his peers. I don't think the same could probably be said for CM Punk. So when, you know, Punk returns and people know that Punk and Cabana have a longstanding beef, and then Cabana basically gets taken off TV and banished to ROH before, by the way, almost getting cut, according to reports, you know, I think the people who like Cabana are going to see that and be upset with Punk, you know, because he's Cabana's, you know, a good guy to have in the locker room, even if he's not pushed, even if he's not a main eventer, even if he's just in the Dark Order. Like, there's value to having good locker room guys in your company, and Colt Cabana can be and is one of those guys. So I think that's – and I think people – you know, I don't want to speak for anyone in AEW, but came in with the understanding that Cabana was on the roster. So for this all to take place, I think makes people, Javier, look at Punk with a little more of a wary eye, and maybe this guy isn't coming in to do what's best for business. Maybe he is looking out for himself, and, you know, that's the last attitude you really need in a locker room like this.
Well, that's what I was going to go. My second point was, that's what I was going to say. The point was, is that I feel like this might be going into business for him, or he's thinking, hey, Tony can't fire me, you know, on the one of the top wrestlers in the world. I don't know. It's just like, I feel like it's he said, she said, and it's just stupid, you know?
Well, the what was I going to say? The other thing it's not just that Colt Cabana is liked backstage. Colt Cabana, you know how you have like a lot of wrestlers now saying that I'm the one responsible for AEW. You have Jericho saying that. You have Jay White saying that. You have all these, you know, the Young Bucks, Cody, the Godfather of all that is Colt Cabana. Colt Cabana the Young Bucks basically consider Colt Cabana a mentor because Colt Cabana was one of the wrestlers that really understood how to market yourself and how to create the Colt Cabana brand, and that's what the Young Bucks did. They created the Young Bucks brand, and then that mentality is what led to the creation of AEW. So, you know, this, you know, to them, he's like it'd be like almost like a relation between like FTR and Bret Hart. You know, it's what brought them into, you know, into this, you know, into what building what they wanted AEW to be. So that's another thing to, you know, consider that, you know, he is like somewhat important to a lot of that part of the wrestlers. I mean, you know, you would like to also consider the fact that, you know, CM Punk is definitely worth more money and is going to draw, you know, draw a bigger crowd. But that's something that really needed to be. You really needed to have some talent management, which they really didn't have, and supposedly they retooled some stuff to get, you know, I think Tony Schiavone might be the one who's going to be in charge of unruffling feathers, but we'll see if that plays out.
All right, DJ, your second question for us.
Wait, let me ask you one quick question. Like, seriously, let's say he wasn't in the Dork Order. Let's say he was by himself or with, like, maybe one tag team. He has such an awesome personality. He's an okay wrestler, but, dude, imagine he was by himself or something and he was a bigger star. I feel like they wouldn't pick on him or go to ROH or something. And also, how many people would pay to see him, CM Punk? Like, oh, my God. You know what I'm saying? Like, come on, bro. So it's just like,
I think you can make the argument that Colt Cabana is underutilized. I like him. I think he has a very interesting, very engaging personality. And there should be a role for him in AEW beyond being in the Dark Order. But, you know, even before CM Punk got there, Javier, it's not like he was pushed as this big name wrestler, you know? So, I mean, what do you think about Colt Cabana and whether or not he could, I mean, how underutilized, I guess, do you think he was then?
Well, I mean, I don't really, I think he's basically going to be on the same level. They could use him basically on the same level as what they're doing with Dustin Rhodes. Well, he'll show up every now and then and do a little something. But I also am surprised they never brought him out for commentary because he was a good commentator for ROH. So that always was like kind of odd. Although that might be also up to him because he said that I believe he had said in interviews that he still considers himself a wrestler and what he likes doing commentary. You know, that's not what he wants to be pigeonholed at. So, But yeah, I mean, I'm fond of him too. So. But yeah, but I mean, again, it's more of like, you know, what he means to the company, like what Dustin Rhodes means to the company, you know, some of those people that are just backstage and they're not really, you know, they're more like coaches in the backs than anything else.
Yeah. And we know that,
you know, I think of.
Right. And we know that wrestlers, you know, pull a lot of double duty in AEW. They have backstage roles beyond what you see on the screen. And you have to imagine given Cabana's worldly travels in the professional wrestling industry that there was something that he was being utilized in doing backstage, I would assume, beyond his participation on screen. All right, DJ, now back to you for your second question.
I just hope we'll figure out what he does because I really hope he has a good personality. I just hope he does go far sooner or later. So my next thing is Kenny Omega. I know they need him back. I don't know if they really need him back right away, but, like, he's so hurt. Like, he can rest. They have Adam Cole or they have the other Adam right now. I feel like at the end of the day, like, I know he's so hurt. He can really hurt himself, people are saying now. And I don't even know if he's fully healed all the way he said. It's just like, why are they rushing him back? It's just like, do they need him right away? I know he has so much stuff going on, you know, with his life and his health and everything. I feel like maybe another couple months, another year, you know, him and Punk can go at her. He can be totally healed 100%. He can, you know, have the matches he really wants. You know, I feel like him coming back is, I don't know, like at the end of the day, where you
well,
guys always think.
DJ, this is another one of these things that seem like it seems like storyline here. And I think, you know, you sort of alluded to it, Javier, a little earlier on.
Yeah.
How much of what we saw on screen with Kenny Omega with the, you know, the shoulder brace and with the moving gently and, you know, it was obvious to the point where it did feel like we were supposed to take notice of just how not 100% he was. So how much of that was Kenny Omega working his way back and how much of it was storyline, do you think?
Yeah, it's storyline. It's the there's a moment where he his leg, you know, gives out, and then like 2 seconds later, he's, you know, doing what we see in every single match that after someone works a leg, that all of a sudden miraculously healed.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, a lot of the stuff. I mean, the only thing that looked like legit, which we speculated on the poster, was knocking out Dragon Lee, the V-trigger to Dragon Lee, where Dragon Lee wasn't responding, it was a great spell job, or he might have actually been knocked out, but yeah.
All right, so DJ, fear not. That was a storyline to make him seem like he was rusty. But anyway, your third and final question.
On a podcast, he did say he was not 100%.
Well, there's that, okay,
yeah.
But there's you don't think he's selling the storyline on the podcast, maybe?
No, but he was saying, like, he still needs to heal up. He's not 100% healed. I mean, it's hernia and stuff. That doesn't just heal overnight. That's, you know.
Could be the case, but they could also be playing it up in storyline to the point that we saw it on television. That's the point.
And
no,
and
I didn't want
wrestlers.
Him getting hurt like Brian or something. You know what I'm saying? So, and he, you know, I just, yeah, so. My last thing is this. I don't
Javier,
know.
Go ahead. Before we go to the last, jump in there, Javier.
Yeah, and the other thing is that the best way to tell a good lie is to root it in the truth, and wrestlers are never 100%, particularly when you have that, you know, length of time, you know, wrestling. So he could very say, oh, yeah, I'm not 100% yet, but, you know, if you ask a wrestler in an interview and say, hey, are you 100%, they will always tell you no because they're never at 100%. It takes a toll on you.
Yeah. We'll see. I just hope he's going to be okay, you know. So my last thing is this. I got a crazy question. Okay, so they did these firings in the UK with NXT, okay? Now, my question is, really, how much of Vince's handprints are really on that compared to did they know this before? Did they just plan this, you know, not too long ago?
Well, I mean, I think that's a good question. You know, they had announced recently, I mean, within the last week, that they were going to be doing an NXT Europe, or that was being reported, and that was going to replace NXT UK. So you're seeing a lot of these UK-based wrestlers get released or brought to NXT. That's why we've seen so many of those wrestlers make their debuts in recent weeks on NXT television. So, yeah, I think the fair question is, Javier, how much of this move from NXT UK to NXT Europe was in the works before Vince McMahon was let go, and how much of it is this has got Triple H's fingerprints on it. You know, there's the famous picture of him with in front of the world map giving a speech and showing where all the NXT properties he wanted to establish all over the world, which of course never happened. The pandemic played a big part in that, but this certainly feels like a Triple H joint, but you also have to imagine that the creation of NXT Europe and the shutting down of NXT UK, that's something you don't do in a week or two. Like, that's something you would think would happen over time. So what's your read on this NXT UK shutdown and the move to NXT Europe?
Oh, shutdowns happen quickly. Once the decision's made, those tend to happen really quick, just because any second you delay, you are throwing money away. I would think that this has probably been in the works no more. I mean, it's already been a couple, you know, it could literally happen in like a week. I've been, you know, part of companies where like there was restructuring that quick. The cleaning out of the part of the restructuring was that quick. The coming back was a little bit slower. And considering the fact they just brought over a whole bunch of UK talent, what it sounds like to me, and you know, I've heard it speculated online, is that essentially they asked the UK talent, those who wanted to relocate to the US, while they set up NXT Europe, they you know, some of them were brought in. The other ones that either A, didn't want to relocate, or were people that are not going to, you know, pay to relocate, or, you know, we're going to use, right now, you let them go, let them, ply their trade. And then when you launch NXT Europe, you bring them back in if they're the people that you want to, you know, continue working with. So I don't think this was like kind of like the same thing of like, you know, we're just going to, you know, budget cut kind of thing. But if you're going to shut down the promotion, you know, it kind of doesn't make – I could see why they would not want to have, like, what was, like, something like 10, 12 people that ended up getting cut. So,
yeah. All right, DJ, thanks for the call.
See you next week.
All right. Speaking of WWE, and it's so nice that these phone calls always dovetail right into our next topic, WWE I don't know how much you've seen of the WWE product since Triple H took over, but if you've seen enough to comment, and I ask this every week because I'm always, you know, this is the most seismic creative change in professional wrestling since I've been alive, so I really do like to get everybody that I talk to on this show their opinions on it. But what's been your take on, you know, Triple H since he's taken over creative?
Yeah, no, it's mentioned a bunch of times that basically just cleaning out all the annoyances, made such a difference for that show, because they have incredible talent. They're not always positioned properly, and the Vince McMahon mentality was, this is the guy I'm going to run with, and to make him look good, we got to make everyone else look bad, as opposed to, you know, let's make everyone look good. And, you know, so, I remarked to my brother the other day, I was like, you know, I think the Tommaso Ciampa reclamation project is done. You could already put him up against Roman Reigns and have him give him the title. And we're talking about a guy that, when Vince McMahon was, booking him for the weeks that Vince McMahon had him, didn't cut a promo, barely talked. Why? Because listen to his voice. He was never going to be allowed to hold a mic. He was never going to be allowed to cut a promo. only promos you saw were the stuff that you would see, for Twitter and social media. You would not see any of that on TV because Vince McMahon wouldn't stand his voice. And then got some of the best promos whenever when he ever cuts a promo on the TV show. So, I'm very optimistic at the signs, really high, because if they could just, the downfall being a 3-hour Raw, you cannot escape that. Looking forward to it, getting some squash matches in. And the thing is that you can't, some people have been like, oh, well, it's the same thing. I'm like, but you are still dealing with a limited roster. You are still dealing with, you're still dealing with baggage. It's not going to change overnight. Not to mention that what people fail to understand is that if you changed, if all of a sudden you turned on Raw and it was all black and gold, you're going to have a sizable portion of your audience just tune out, because I did when NXT became NXT 2.0. I stopped watching NXT because, I saw the garish freaking, colors that almost gave me, a seizure, and I'm like, no, I'm done. It was a jumping off point for me. And it was, and so if you give somebody, that kind of shock to the system and don't bring them along gradually, you're going to eliminate a lot of people that you might not bring back, the other kind of more discerning fans, quote unquote. You're not going to necessarily bring them back. So it's going to be a slow process, and the quick thing you do is eliminate the annoyances, the demeaning wrestlers, and good start. Looking, the fields are being plowed very well, basically.
Yes, I agree on that. An email question from Brian. He says, hi, Greg, if you were Triple H, would you consider having Paul Heyman book one of the television shows so Triple H, is not spread too thin, especially in light of his health concerns? And this is a good point, and I think it's something that bears watching. Not only is Triple H heading creative, but he's also head of talent relations. And this is during a time where the expectation, said and unsaid, was that Triple H would be scaling back his duties in WWE significantly because of his health scare. And now he's taken on two of the most stressful positions within WWE. So I guess, to go along with that question is really, how long can we expect Triple H to pull double duty on this without getting someone the level of a Heyman? He's got Bruce Pritchard still helping him out, and he's certainly got a full creative team that, he may be delegating a lot more to them maybe than Vince McMahon did, so it may not be as stressful as Vince made it seem when he was tearing up scripts in the middle of the afternoon on the day of a show. But, a Paul Heyman or someone like that, do you ever see Triple H sort of handing off the reins just to get a little bit off his plate, knowing what he's been through recently?
Well, I just before I came on saw a report somewhere, I should have written down who, that it sounds like he's working getting the band back together and bringing the people who were helping him in NXT to help run WWE. So that looks like that's already going to be in the works. I've got a conspiracy theory that both the Stephanie stepping down and Triple H's health issue were all just, a smoke screen as they planned to take down Vince.
So, you're not the first person to float that either.
Yeah, if you work, and seriously, if you work off of that premise, there are a lot of stuff that makes sense. Which is fun to speculate, but I'm not going to do that here. He's going to be, it's what he likes to do too. So if it's something that you're enjoying, that goes a long way to mitigating all that stuff. And particularly now we're right now we're in the, rosy period, the honeymoon period. That's what we're
honeymoon
for.
Phase.
We're in the honeymoon phase where, reports have been coming out that some wrestlers know that they're basically screwed. A lot of wrestlers are happy over it. the only ones, obviously you have some that, well, what does this mean for my push? And you can kind of imagine, the kind of wrestler might be in that Almost. I'm speaking of almost.
very subtle there.
You know, there are a couple others too, but you know, a lot of, I mean, if your T-bar, are you happy? You're going to be happy with your T-bar, you know?
Yeah.
Aren't you? I mean, because this could only be better for you.
Right.
So we'll see what ends up happening. I mean, the only like thing I'd be worried about if he brings in too many of his, you know, friends and the people he's fallen in love with, you know, because I mean, that would be like the worry about Karrion Kross. I'm higher on Karrion Kross than, you know, I'm not super high, but you know, I see that there's potential in Karrion Kross. If you use him well, but like, you know, if he starts bringing in like other talents are just obviously, if he's choosing people over people who are talented, you know, no one's going to complain if Gargano comes in, no one's going to complain, you know, a lot of these people come in, I you know, so, you know, because at least the people that he does like are people who are, you're not going to complain about. Like, if he brings back Adam Cole after, you know, his contract expires, that sort of thing, people are not going to complain about that.
Yeah, I mean, the Heyman stuff, you know, I think his Raws were pretty well received overall when he had that brief run as executive director of Raw. So I think that would be, you know, if you were going to hand it off, he's already in the WWE family. He's already under contract. He's already appearing with Roman Reigns, so it would be someone like Paul Heyman. I think he could probably do worse than that. And you also have to wonder how long Heyman wants to do that. Like, how long does he want to deal with the stress of writing a TV show, although it's probably less stressful writing under Triple H than it would be writing under Vince McMahon. So there's that. Want to go to – we got one more email and one more phone call to get to. So let's go to the phone, the 419 area code. I believe this is Craig from Toledo. Craig, is that you with us?
It sure is. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. Hi, Craig.
I hope you guys are well. I was wondering, and I know it doesn't dovetail into anything that you guys are already talking about right now, but I was wondering what you thought, Javier, about the format of the G1 this year as it played out in – you know, since you've seen it play out. And do you think they should stick with this format or go back to the other way?
Well, I mentioned some of the stuff already, but in terms of like where to stick, what I would like to see is an actual even number of wrestlers per block. So right now there's 7. If you're going to keep 4 blocks, I'd like to see 8. That way you don't, because I'd rather get like maybe you have all A and B 1 week, and then all of C and D, not 1 week, 1 day, then C and D the other day. And, you know, something like that to be a little bit more, you know, because, like, in this with this format, you ended up, like I said, you had some wrestlers that, like, were completely off for the first, like, 2 weeks. And then they had back-to-back-to-back matches. I think Okada was one of them. I think Okada had 3 back-to-back matches, you know, at the end, and they were all high-level matches. So, which I think to me kind of also defeats the purpose of them getting rest. So, yeah. You know, because there was no Yano match in between. I was negative at first. Well, I was cautious at first, you know, because when I saw the, you know, because I was like, oh, 4 blocks? We're going to get a whole bunch of people from AEW. We're going to get a whole bunch of people from this. And then I saw Fale, Yujiro. I like Chase, but, you know, Chase. You know, and I saw a lot of names. I'm like, well, wow, who's coming from outside? I mean, there was no Carl Anderson. There was, you know, some people I would like to have seen. And so I was actually already kind of going into it a little bit disappointed in the blocks and the people who were going to be involved. And I was hoping for, you know, more surprise talent showing up on the, you know, in the blocks. But, you know, as time went on, I liked it. I think there are pluses and negatives. I think to me it's kind of like a wash. If they go back to 2 blocks with 10, you know, 2 blocks, I'd be fine with it. I'd just tweak this one a little bit to really, you know, particularly get that. But, you know, this is more of an opinion thing than as opposed to just analyzing something.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up because I had forgotten about that. I mentioned it on a previous show when I was running down the G1 results very early on in the tournament when you had just the mismatch of when wrestlers were having their matches. And I think that was one, if you want to make it as sports-like and as fair as possible, I think you'd have to fix that somehow in the next few years. But Craig, back to you for your next question for us.
Yeah, I was wondering also, I know you guys can only speculate, but do you guys think there was something that happened in that they thought there was going to be more AEW talent or whatever, and it just fell through because of something that happened, or just was it just a logistical thing? Did they have a falling out? Was it something with the Forbidden Door or whatever? What do you guys think of that?
Personally, I don't think there was anything – any falling out. I mean, when you do that, you got to plan well in advance, you know, and talk to people well in advance and make sure they're okay going to Japan for a lengthy period. And, you know, I think it was always going to be tough because, you know, the guys that New Japan would really want from AEW would be probably too valuable to AEW TV to lose for that amount of time, especially with AEW being bombarded by injuries at this point. And so, you know, that would be a risk from AEW's point of view that they may not have been willing to sign off on. So I don't think there was any, you know, second guessing from AEW about, you know, loaning them a wrestler and then saying, you know what, on second thought, no. I don't think there's any bad blood about it. But, you know, I think it may be one of those things where you want to see how it plays out 1 year. And if you're Tony Khan, you kind of see how the four blocks go, how the booking works. And then maybe if they come back and do the same thing next year, you say, okay, yeah, I'll give you a guy or two here. Obviously, you know, Lance Archer being in the tournament and being an AEW guy is one, but he's got a history with New Japan. So that's a little different than giving him a Bryan Danielson to use or anything like that. Javier, what's your take on that situation?
Well, there was something that Kevin Kelly early on mentioned in commentary that, like, if I parse his words correctly, you know, because you know how, like, commentators actually tell you what's really going on and, you know, like, hidden speak, it almost felt like there were supposed to be more people involved that likely Yujiro would not have been in the tournament because something fell through, because he did mention something about something falling through. And that might have been like a Daniel Bryan or a Moxley in the tournament, and things changed when CM Punk went down. So I think that is a possibility. And then, like, in terms of AEW, you know, who do you have that, you also have to factor in whether the person wants to be there. Because I'd love to see Miro in a G1, but who does Miro want to be in a G1? You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, my thing was, I was also hoping not just AEW talent on there, because I mean, we got, and I don't really want to count Archer as AEW since we're Suzuki going for, like, you know, ever. You know, I was also surprised no Impact talent showed up. You know, but again, it is also a month long trend. A month-long commitment. You're essentially off the market for a full month.
Right, yeah. All right, Craig, anything else for us tonight?
Yeah, just one more thing. And I'm sorry if you already discussed this too, but overall, I don't know how many G1s you guys have watched. I've been watching every year for the past, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years. And I was wondering what your ranking would be as far as this one goes compared to other ones, because I missed this whole year because I was in the hospital for first half of it. And I can't do that thing where people just go and watch something that's already happened and, you know, everybody's already talked about it. But where would you guys, like, put it in the rankings as far as the ones you've watched? And thanks for taking my call, guys. Hope you have a good week.
All right. Thank you, Craig. Hope you're feeling better. I didn't pay all that close attention to the last couple years just because of the pandemic really throwing a wrench into what the G1 is supposed to be and what it's all about and the attraction of the G1. So I would rank this, you know, I did see some of the key matches and some of the key nights from the last couple of years, but I would probably rank this one ahead of those. I think I've been watching the G1s as long as Craig, maybe a little longer, but in the same ballpark. And it just, I do think the lack of fan participation that's allowed does impact my enjoyment of the show. And, you know, so I would rank this behind some of the others that I saw, especially early on. I mean, you didn't have Minoru Suzuki in this, so that's, I mean, that downgrades it a little in my mind, too. But, you know, it was good, and there were some strong Match of the Year contenders, potentially Match of the Year winners coming out of this G1 tournament. So it's not like it was a complete waste, but it didn't have, to me, the same – it didn't have the same feel for whatever reason as some of the other some of the other G1s I've seen 5, 6, 7 years ago, as Craig said.
Yeah, I definitely better than the pandemic years by a whole large margin. The first one I saw, I think, was the one that Omega won. What year, which one was that one? 29, I think. No, it wasn't 29. You remember which one it was?
I'm really bad with dates, so I'm not the person to ask.
I believe that was the first one. I'm pretty sure the first one I saw was the one that Kenny Omega won. So and that was my favorite. I mean, that one had one of my favorite matches of all time. It's hard to really think of how it compares to the ones that weren't that one, because that one sticks in my mind because of that reason. But I thought it stacks up nicely. I think it stacks up nicely. Although I think I agree with you, Greg, that it was the crowd cheering does add like an extra level, because it lets you lose yourself more in what's going on. Which is why I really like the Osaka crowds, because the Osaka crowds don't care. And there are moments where the Osaka crowds were, you know, you could hear them. During the, I don't know if it was my imagination, could have been my imagination, just the clap cadence, where there was one of the falls finishes of the Osprey Okada finals, there was a segment of the audience that sounded to me like they're saying, "Will Osprey." So, there were moments like the torpedo, when Jonah went up to hit the torpedo on Okada, there was a collapse, you know, like, oh, you know, like a, you know, people raising their voices. So, you know, it does feel like the fans are about as annoyed just being clapping crowds as we are.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mentioned, you know, they're not being, Suzuki. I mean, you also have to think of who else was in some of those older tournaments. Kota Ibushi, no Ibushi in this one. Kenny Omega, as you mentioned, no Omega in this one. So, it, you know, you're missing quite a few high-level performers who were in those other ones that you're comparing this one to. So I think that does hurt it as well. We're down to our last email here, and this is from John, who, God bless him, writes in, and he writes a novel. And we've read his emails on the show a few times. There are five questions in here, and there's a long preface to each one. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the preface, I'm going to read the question, and then we'll stop and talk about the question, and then go back to the email. So get ready. This is from John. He says, "Hi, Greg and co-host. First of all, I want to say that there's nothing wrong with doing face heel if it's done unbelievably well, and it is a reliable approach to wrestling that has worked well for decades. What I'm suggesting is simply an alternative or something that can be mixed in with face heel and maybe help add more realism to the product, especially long term. There are no right or wrong answers, in my opinion. Shades of Grey won't just magically make everything better, not if the writing isn't capable of reaching as close to perfect levels as possible. but it is a suggestion to try something different, and if done well, it may correct many of the storytelling problems that have made the product seem less logical and immersive over the years with characters doing things that don't make sense and sometimes a lack of flow. After the recent change, because it's only been a few weeks, in the creative fulcrums of WWE with Triple H replacing Vince McMahon, the former is getting so much credit already, I also have optimism. But I think some fans are just so excited that Vince has finally been ousted from power that they may be attributing things to him that Vince may have done anyway. Because even Vince did some things, occasionally right and creative, like pushing and protecting Bobby Lashley for so long. I think this soon is simply too difficult to make a true objective assessment of what Triple H's reign will look like. There are some good signs, like the video packages highlighting the history and prestige of the U.S. and Intercontinental titles, and the likes of Kevin Owens and Matt Riddle shifting to a more serious side, and returns and debuts including previously released NXT talent. Also, the announcers using the word fans a little more often, although even under Vince, they did occasionally say fans already, just not nearly as often as the last few weeks. There were also long matches on TV most weeks under Vince. The main changes have been how these matches like Styles Lashley and Nakamura Gunther have been presented and built up as important, and that is very impressive, and I'm pleased with these subtle changes. Add in the varied use of the word wrestling, which was also used from time to time on the show under Vince, like Daniel Bryan telling John Cena he's a wrestler, and the latter an entertainer, leading to their SummerSlam match among them. And there have been noticeable changes for sure, but they've still been more subtle, which is smart, because it would seem too unnatural on air for people to completely stop saying universe or other buzzwords all of a sudden at the snap of a finger. Gradual is probably best, in my opinion. I'm very patient with him in charge and also very optimistic and think a year to a year and a half is a fair amount of time to see what he can do. After all, making wholesale changes to an organization that has been doing things a certain way for a long time almost never has quick positive results. It takes time to implement new philosophy and playing style in sports. Don't forget, his changes on the show may also reach shareholders in Wall Street and other key people, so it is a very complex process. I'm very optimistic about the Triple H run area, but also keeping a balanced view on what we've seen so far. Question: how long are you willing to give Triple H to put his stamp on the product, and are you looking for big changes or lots of small changes? Javier, I'll let you take this one first because I got to get some water.
Actually, first, you repeat all that? I needed to take notes, man.
Don't even pull that with me.
It's what I mentioned, that you don't want to do wholesale, tear everything out, because you're going to create a culture shock, essentially. Smaller changes. First, fix the annoying stuff that's easy to fix. We've already seen a lot. And the one thing I disagree with with what he said is, he has a back catalog of work that we've seen. It's NXT. If you were able to grok his booking philosophy based on when you saw in NXT and you start seeing echoes of it in the WWE, you could kind of chart where you expect things to go next. But it takes time. You've got to build up the talent. I had actually read, or I think about it, I didn't read it. My brother said it, so take what I said, say with a grain of salt, he read somewhere that Vince had ordered the burying of Gunther. Because apparently he didn't like him before he was ousted. So, like, that sort of stuff, he's presenting him well in that Shinsuke Nakamura match. And one of the things that really strikes out to me is that the wrestling in the ring is important. The way it's shot, the way it's, there's still some Kevin Dunnisms there. But in terms of, like, the attention being in what's going on in the ring, in the moves, in the storytelling, that to me is the most important thing. Is that, which is something that prior administration just did not care. The match was just something that killed time before your next angle.
Yeah, in terms of how long am I willing to give Triple H to put his stamp on the product, I mean, John already gave several examples of Triple H putting his stamp on the product. I don't think, Triple H recognizes he's a smart enough guy to know that he can't book Raw and SmackDown the same way he booked NXT. He knows he was booking for a niche audience, and he knows that Raw and SmackDown have to appeal to a broader audience. And the fans that are still watching the product, they're watching for a reason. Most of them are watching because they liked what they saw. And we can sit here and disagree and pick apart everything, but and that's another reason wholesale changes would be a bad idea. It's just sort of re-teaching the audience your booking philosophy and giving them time to accept it. Looking for big changes or lots of small changes? I think lots of small changes at first. We've seen some big changes with some new wrestlers coming in and just kind of the need to rebuild the mid-card, but I would also say that the big changes will probably come later because you don't, as John laid out and as we've talked about, you don't want to make those big changes necessarily right away. Okay, second part. There are also some glaring issues that remain from Vince's time in charge, which leads to my first point. Should WWE embrace or at least consider a more shades of gray approach across most of their programming and start to phase out the whole babyface and heel divide? This came to mind recently after watching a series of segments involving Edge and the Judgment Day and Rey Mysterio in the past couple weeks. First was the Edge promo after returning at SummerSlam, where he briefly touched on his babyface turn and villainous past with the Judgment Day, where he played a completely different character, and the other segment was earlier this week when that same trio attacked Rey Mysterio and there's a complete absence of good guys from the locker room helping out poor Rey. These instances, among other on a weekly basis, highlighted to me the weakness in the babyface heel system and the restrictions of WWE's lack of logic in their characters and storylines from time to time. Watching segments like these only has me thinking of people playing roles and how it is a production, and it feels impossible for me in the moment to be immersed in their world when my mind keeps thinking, why was Edge dressed all in black and calling people sheep and taking cheap shots at others, and now he's all of a sudden a good guy again? Why? I think Dominic had every right to be suspicious of Edge given his history and who he was just a couple of months prior. I don't like thinking these kinds of things when watching entertainment because I want to be fully immersed in the world I am watching on screen. A character changing at the drop of a hat for illogical reasons comes across as quite jarring, whether it's watching The Blacklist, The Godfather, or a great superhero movie, or even most completely made works of fiction, or competently made works of fiction. I don't constantly think about leaps in logic or questioning character motivations, because if the writing and the performances show respect to the audience, then I and others don't have to be distracted with these questions. On a show like The Blacklist, there are protagonist characters that do some incredibly morally great things, and if you watch the first episode, you probably won't predict some of the things these characters do in the 10th or 15th episode, but their actions are still believable if you trace their development, and there is character growth because of how great the writing is. Characters' motivations are clear, and there are no sharp turns just for the sake of it, or because someone's bored of their character. I get that there are differences between a show with a live audience and a scripted and rehearsed suspenseful TV show, but I think there are still things to be learned about the great writing, structure, and character development. The Blacklist is one of the best shows ever, so they are tough standards to reach, and it's a different kind of show, but I'm sure there are some valuable lessons which could prove helpful. The Rey Judgment Day segment, while the performances were good and it was still a good overall segment for what it was attempting, was a big disappointment to some who like to get immersed in what I'm watching, largely because if this was real life, I would imagine people with compassion backstage busting a gut trying to help a beloved guy like Rey Mysterio potentially having his career ended with a serious injury. I'm not saying someone should have ran out there if that was not the story they wanted to tell, but if a commentator threw out a line like, the Judgment Day instilled so much fear in the locker room, those in the back watching this are probably second-guessing themselves, or Adam Pearce has forbid anyone from getting involved because he doesn't want any further injuries or chaos, or something similar, then I think it would have gone a long way to filling a massive hole in logic. They could have even showed a bunch of the baby faces being held back by security or by Pierce as some referees and officials make their way to the ring while also trying to keep others from getting involved and potentially causing further injury. Question. Do you think the babyface heel approach has any weaknesses or does it feel outdated? And do you think both that and Shades of Grey can be blended? Javier, babyface heel or Shades of Grey?
Yeah, I mean, this is like a thesis question. it all depends because first off, we've got to define what babyface and heel is, because the way I personally see it is not necessarily good guy, bad guy, but who you want to succeed versus who do you want to fail. When The Fiend was doing his stuff, he was a bad guy. He was trying to take out people, but you wanted to see him succeed because he had motivations. It, just like you kind of, if you watch Avengers Endgame, you're kind of almost rooting for Thanos because he's the protagonist of the movie. Infinity War. You know, Thanos is the protagonist of that. It's his story. So, I do believe that the best thing to do is to have someone you want to root for, someone you are rooting against. you could do what would be good guy versus good guy in terms of like one of the earliest memories I had. And one of the things that, that got me interested in wrestling was Hulk Hogan versus Ultimate Warrior. And, you know, I was cheering for the Ultimate Warrior because he was the new guy and he was replacing the old guard at that, you know, which was the story they were telling at that time. And it was a babyface versus babyface matchup. But, you know, you were drawn into it because of that drama involved. So the thing is that sometimes you use babyface and heel just as a as an easy stopgap to, you know, to do so. So ultimately it's telling the best story you could possibly tell with the what you have. And usually that does involve making you want to really root for one guy, usually because he's good, and root against the other person, usually because he's bad.
That's the easiest story to tell. Just because WWE has had trouble telling it over the years does not mean it's inherently a bad system. It's only a bad system when the people writing it are not doing well, and Vince is constantly changing his mind and you know, having babyfaces do heelish things. And so is there room for shades of gray storytelling? Absolutely. But it comes from a place of babyface heel, right? I think that's the important part, is deep down, there's someone you want to root for, and someone you don't want fans in the live audience saying, geez, I don't know which guy to cheer for. Like, you want them cheering for somebody. You want that big pop for somebody. That's the whole, you know, point. So I think that's where I kind of come down, and I think you can do shades of gray, but ultimately it comes from a place of, you know, babyface on the Blacklist, and I like the Blacklist. I don't know if I'd go so far as to say it's one of the greatest shows, but I enjoy it. You know, it's ultimately, you know, the good guys are the good guys and the bad guys are the bad guys. And sometimes the good guys do questionable things like they said, but it's for the usually the best of intentions. So they're still baby faces. You know, I think that's really the best way to do it. Okay, back to the email.
Or for understandable reasons. You know, that's the other thing. It's for understandable reasons. Because sometimes not best intentions, like, you know, but, you know, so you understand why they made that decision. And I mean, that ultimately is what it is. You know, as quick aside, like, that actually came up during the G1. Hiroshi Tanahashi started doing some heelish stuff against a solid babyface wrestler. And, you know, Kevin Kelly brought up that, you know, Tanahashi's not afraid to don the black hat when he needs to get, you know, something done. So, you know, that's kind of part of the character.
Okay, back to the email. I say that because people in real life are rarely 100% good or 100% evil, and everyone has some rhyme or reason for doing just about anything. People in real life are often complex beings. If you want to be cartoonish, then embrace that across the board. Otherwise, it comes across as too unrealistic. It also doesn't help that villains in WWE often come across as varying degrees of cartoonish. Heroes and villains work in a superhero movie or most blockbusters, but real life just isn't always black and white. I agree having honorable people and underhanded villains, especially if they're played well, but you can be underhanded or upstanding as part of a complete and complex character as well, who may do things for reasons that go against their nature from time to time in order to achieve a specific goal, without that having to mean they have automatically gone from a good guy to a bad guy or vice versa. Neither is sports full of heroes and villains. Some athletes are great role models to kids and people of all ages, but there are also athletes who make public mistakes and get scrutinized for some bad calls in the moment, both on and off their turf. If WWE takes a more short sport approach and veers a little away from the cheesy comic-filled sports entertainment, then I think it could benefit them to try having at least some more characters less aligned one way or another. I grew up watching the Attitude Era, and while there were obviously babyfaces and heels throughout the roster, it wasn't always black and white. Steve Austin was essentially still the same guy as a babyface than when he was a heel, but with some tweaks and different enemies. There were also characters that did things that were far from by the babyface book, and it was one of the hottest periods in wrestling history. I'm not saying return to the Attitude Era, but using it as an example of some things done in that era that I think WWE going completely away from may have been a tad hasty. Seth Rollins coming out in his outlandish outfits and cackling to excess just doesn't scream reality era to me, and he doesn't come across as a real person. You contrast him to someone like Roman or even Theory, and I don't believe most of the words he says just because of how over the top he is. There's nothing necessarily wrong with a babyface and heel system if done well, but it feels like it has some limitations and allows for more cartoonish elements and performers transitioning from one character to another, completely different characters so quickly. I think Shades of Grey in wrestling has a bit of a bad reputation because it perhaps has been executed poorly at times in the past when it has occasionally been done. I think if executed in a sophisticated way, it could be a huge advantage to the way WWE tells stories. You can still have a strong straight-up babyface and heels because some performers are excellent in those roles, but I think implementing more shades of gray in a more logical and sophisticated way, perhaps using it on a selective basis at first, could enhance the current storytelling. Question. If sticking to babyfaces and heels, who would be your top five in both categories in the whole company based on who is on the roster currently? Well, I mean, Roman Reigns, Seth Rollins, Gunther, those are my top three heels. Kevin Owens, maybe? Like, I don't know, Kevin Owens, babyface or heel. Probably he's needed more as a babyface right now. So let's go Drew McIntyre, Bobby Lashley, Kevin Owens as babyfaces. I mean, I'm going to throw Bianca Belair and Becky Lynch as babyfaces and Charlotte Flair and Bayley as heels, I guess. That's just off the top of my head. I did not look at this email ahead of time. So I'm doing this in the moment just as you're going to be doing, Javier, so I'm not cheating or anything. But kind of a left turn from the question. Top five baby faces and heels, if you were sticking with the baby face heel system.
Yeah, baby faces, I've done that. I think that's the easier one. Baby faces right now, Drew McIntyre, Bobby Lashley, Mysterio. Okay, Street Profits are weird because I'm more with the Street Profits before Triple H took over, you know, like that version, because they seem to be in some sort of transition right now. So that's who I'm going with. Riddle. Those are my five baby faces. Male baby faces. And female, I would throw in Bianca, like, you know, as a matter of fact, if I were to rank them, I'd probably put her second. And we can't really say Becky because, you know, unfortunately, she got hurt. So those would be on that side. Were they all Raw people?
For baby faces?
Yeah,
I mean, you said Drew. He's Raw, but he's more SmackDown lately.
Yeah, just a coincidence. Heel's a little bit harder because Miz is heel. It's hard. See, Roman Reigns right now is kind of in the tweenerville. So, in the shades of gray, he's doing things for his family, which is a morally positive thing. But at the same time, he's, you know, taking liberties, which is a negative thing. So, and it seems like he's kind of like he's definitely kind of in the middle right now in terms of that. But the Miz. Bailey, Ms. Bailey, Charlotte when she comes back. I mean, she is heel. Sasha Banks when she comes back, no matter how she's portrayed, it's gonna be Sasha Banks. It's hard to pick up the next one. I'll go with those four. I'll think if the other one pops to mind. I'll because most of the other heels are like kind of like more joke kind of characters than people take seriously.
All right, we've passed the halfway point of the email. So,
oh my God!
Speaking of Roman, this brings me to my next topic: Roman Drew at Clash of the Castle. The next topic is independent of the whole Shades of Grey versus Babyface and Heel discussion. And if going with Babyface is on top, Drew McIntyre showed on Raw earlier this week why he is so great at it. About a month ago, I proposed that Roman lose the title, but only to someone on a hot streak or someone new to the roster who gives off special next top guy vibes. I suggested Riddle on a hot streak going into SummerSlam, or perhaps Theory cashing in and taking one or both titles. However, Drew McIntyre is an ideal person to end this magnificent title reign. I am not the kind of person who makes hyperbolic statements, and whenever I hear that someone in wrestling must do something, I slightly roll my eyes, not because I think the person saying it is saying anything wrong necessarily, but because there are often multiple ways to do things and very rarely just one option. For instance, in the 2014 and 2015 Royal Rumble matches, I didn't think Daniel Bryan must be in and win either of them, even though I would have liked it and thought it was the best option, but there were other ways to tell his story as an underdog. I didn't think this going into Monday, but Drew's fiery babyface promo on Raw was just so fantastically performed and written that I think in order to capitalize on this momentum and to further cement the new Triple H era as his own and also commemorate WWE's biggest show in the UK in 30 years, as they keep pointing out, I think if Drew fails to win, even if he's screwed by Cross or anyone else, could set McIntyre back several paces. That promo with Kevin Owens on Raw changed everything. Question. What are your thoughts as a whole on the Drew KO promo segment on Raw, and were you as high on it as me and others, and did it change your opinion on who should slash will win at Clash of the Castle? You know, I thought it was strong. I don't think it was a game changer to me. Whatever I thought going in probably was what I thought going out. I did think that Kevin Owens was probably the most impressive because that seemed to come out of nowhere and seems to be a change in direction for Kevin Owens that's much needed. I think I would love to somehow do something where McIntyre wins one of the titles at Clash of the Castle, because I think that the two titles on Reigns thing is not working for me. But you can't really do that without saying ahead of time that the match is only for one of the titles, and I feel like that kind of gives away the game and kind of gives away that McIntyre would win. Unless you do something where he wins and then, like, on SmackDown the next week, Heyman says, did you read this clause in the contract that said only one title was on the line? I mean, you could get away with doing something like that, I suppose. That way Drew is still champion, but Roman Reigns retains one of the championships. So, you know, back to the question, I guess, is what did you think of the Drew promo, and did it change your mind on who should or you think will go over at Clash of the Castle?
Well, I loved the Drew Kevin Owens promo. I actually messaged Dwayne, which I usually don't do during shows, and I'm like, he's probably busy. And, you know, I'm like, I had tears at the end of that, not of happiness with, you know, how, like, happy I was with the direction these two characters had taken, mainly because of it signposted the change in both characters. The Drew part of it, I was really happy with because Kevin Owens brought up essentially what our critiques of Drew McIntyre has been his character lately, and then Drew McIntyre saying, you know, yeah that you know it's true, but then he reiterated essentially everything that brought him up to that point, you know, by talking about how he got fired and he went through that story again, which he hadn't talked about in a long time, as basically a reset of, like, you know, this felt like the Drew McIntyre who first, you know, who carried the company during the no crowd era. So I was, you know, so it was less necessary the content and whether the content was fiery enough or what have you. It's the meaning behind the words that he said, that this is now, this is the Drew McIntyre who was killed when he lost that match in, at WrestleMania. I've cut promos on that because I had written that if McIntyre does not beat Bobby Lashley at the first WrestleMania with live fans in, whoever's booking has got to get shot, and he lost that match. So, and I think that's what kind of not only deflated the fans' like for the character, but I think also deflated Drew himself. And I felt like this was their way to start to right the ship. I completely agree with the writer that it is set for him to win the title in the UK, and then that elevate him. The thing is that with the amount of time that we have, I don't think that they've gotten it as hot as it needs to be. I'm thinking that what might end up happening is that Karrion Kross might get involved in the match. It becomes a three-way. And it becomes one of those matches where each fall is for a title. So the first fall, they both pin Karrion Kross basically, and each falls, you know, one wins one title, and then Drew McIntyre wins it off of Karrion Kross by pinning Karrion Kross, as opposed to so Roman loses the title, but he doesn't take the pin. and you know, I'm split because it means much less for Drew, much you know, you're not totally protecting Roman, but you're still protecting Roman. People are going to forget about it, you know, come WrestleMania. You still have the heathen pin. So that I think that's what they might end up doing. So the question is whether do you just crown Drew McIntyre now? And is Drew McIntyre the person you want that Triple H wants to crown? That's the other question. I think the next couple shows. How many shows do we have until Clash?
It's got to be. Well, let me look. Clash at the Castle is September 3rd.
So that's 2 weeks, right?
Two? Yeah.
Yeah, so it'll be four shows. You might be able to get it there in four shows, I think, if both of them are storylines being advanced in both programs. So you might be able to get him to the point where people are going to be salivating to watch him to want him to win the title. But I think we need a couple more face-to-face promos and really hype that up. But I completely agree with Drew was poised to be the guy by winning that WrestleMania. That was screwed. This is your next best shot. And if he, I really think that he needs to win. Although you need to get him there first, and I don't think he's there yet.
I know wrestling isn't always getting what you deserve, but man, after leading WWE through the pandemic and being the champion in empty arenas, wouldn't it be fitting that he wins the title back in his home country in front of a stadium-sized crowd? I mean, that would be – what a thumbs-up that would be for him for being the guy
that
to carry
moment,
WWE
just,
through the
just,
pandemic, yeah.
That moment, him standing there and the thing exploding in the background, you know, the fireworks. I mean, that is that moment.
Yeah.
That's the moment that you could actually – that he becomes your top guy. And you need a top guy if Roman Reigns is going to go part-time. I agree with that. And I mean – and I would – granted, this is actually out of order in terms of how, you know, things, you know, happen in the mythology. But I would start with him taking the sword and throwing it into the lake and, like, a woman's arm grabbing it. You know, he's returning the sword to the, you know, the sword to lay in the lake. You know, that way you get rid of the sword, finally, in a really cool spot moment. You know, Greg, do you want that? That would be something that would happen after he wins, but, you know. But just do it in the beginning. That way you're actually underlying no more swords, no more goofy, you know, stuff, just straight up badass.
Yeah.
I'm going to kick your ass, Drew.
And the final section of the email and last question coming up. It's usually no shame losing to Roman Reigns of all people, but if you want a strong babyface to lead you forward and potentially be your next top guy, I don't think a loss of any kind would help him. After that speech, I just think giving him the strongest win of all would help bring him to a level his performances and talent merit. Drew talked about being a workhorse, including being on Raw on his day off, and was so inspirational in his speech and brought hope, especially in a storyline sense, to the fans and locker room, saying that he will be a fighting champion and proud of it, and that I think it outweighs the benefits of having Roman around part-time as champion after exceeding 600 days. I actually have no problem with the part-time thing, as there were times throughout the early to mid parts of his title reign where I was like, he's out there, but doesn't really have anything new to say. And he was feuding with mid-carders like Cesaro, with all due respect. And so many were not built up enough to be a threat to him, so it felt like he was wasting time just hanging around so often, especially in between his bigger feuds. Being around less makes him feel more special when he does appear. However, he can be part-time without being the champion. This isn't 1989 when you have four pay-per-views and Saturday night's main event specials only aside from house shows. It's just a different world, and I think, as I said, Roman being part-time does make him seem more special even as champion. I think it works better if you have at least a second world champion. It makes him seem more special, but since WWE hasn't made a huge effort to have more stars at or close to his level in recent years, the reliance on him also doesn't necessarily help the show as a whole, because the only guy who's by far your biggest star isn't around as often, and who is around have been fairly misbooked and underutilized at times. At this moment, I just think a really hot babyface, if sticking to babyfaces and heels, as champion is probably the best option, unless maybe if you have a long-term plan for Roman to drop the title at WrestleMania or beyond. Having a newly hot babyface on top again, who has all the tools to be true leader and top guy as your undisputed world champion, could be monumental in my opinion. Drew could be a strong babyface again, and we could finally get the reign he never had in front of fans and see how far he can go. Roman has been awesome, but after 600-plus days, it feels like the right time to transition to a new top champion, and after his speech on Raw, I think Drew is the only believable choice right now to become a fighting champion who can help transition out of a recent chapter in WWE's history and add a little more energy at the top of the card. You could have Drew lose, and it doesn't have to destroy him, but I think at this moment in time, going the route of protecting him would be less effective compared to if this was the plan a month ago when he was dwindling someone in the upper mid-card and carrying a sword around, which I'm glad he doesn't bring to the ring anymore. He gave maybe the best promo of his career on Raw this past week, and he was so utterly believable in everything he said that I think not capitalizing on it in the best way possible may just set fans' expectations for him in the future too low and give the impression that he cannot rise above a certain level, equal or above Roman Reigns. McIntyre winning over Reigns is something I wouldn't propose for any other wrestler in WWE at this very moment, as I think his promo and him not losing that often in recent times, even when he was somewhat floundering on SmackDown, makes him perhaps the only believable person to defeat Roman at this moment in time and not weakening Reigns. Question, how could you book the finish of the match between Reigns and McIntyre at Clash of the Castle? Keep up the great work. I mean, if you go with McIntyre winning, Claymore, 1-2-3. I think it's got to be clean. I don't think it's necessary, and John laid out all the reasons why, you know, a loss isn't necessarily going to hurt Roman. I don't think you want to dilute Drew's win by having a distraction or having, you know, the Usos' interference backfire or whatever like that. If you're going to crown him, there's no half measures. Crown him. Have McIntyre get the win, 1-2-3. And, you know, this also adds a different dimension to Roman's character. We have not really seen this character without the title. What does he do? How does he act? What does he say? So for so long, it's been the same Roman Reigns character. I think it actually can benefit his character by not having the title around and freshen him up a little. Javier, what do you think?
Yeah, I would say two claymores, like, you know, the first one stuns him, the second one takes him out. Or, again, one thing that we don't really see anymore, we saw a little bit of that in the current G1, he unveils a new finisher. So he hits the claymore, does not work, and then he hits him with something else with his new finisher. And if there's anything judging by, you know, the last couple of weeks of wrestling under Triple H, they've opened up the playbook considering the fact AJ Styles in the first match in the Triple H regime went for the Styles Clash within 2 seconds into this match. So, you know, maybe something slam, you know, something slammy, some sort of slam to, you know, something new, you know, because then not only that, now you have this unbeatable finisher that you protect. That is how he defends his title for and give him a decent long title reign. And then, Roman Reigns, does he fall apart, lose his mind, and becomes more and more aggressive and more, you know, unhinged, leading to The Rock having to come to WrestleMania to stop him? You know, again, that's, you know, you have stuff you can do. All of this speculation, though, is like you got to factor in Karrion Kross. Because that's the fly in the ointment, because he seems like he's really involved in with stuff that's going on now. I was hoping that they would resolve that in a match, like, but that should have happened, like, yesterday. Or, you know, 2 days ago on Friday to get him out of the way. That is my concern, is him, you know, buzzing around. I mentioned, like, Vince McMahon's booking philosophy is, like, basically just a spotlight on one thing. And, like, you know, just one, you know, sharp spotlight. And the thing is that you're now basically, you know, and you're introducing Karrion Kross, and that's drawing attention away from this, you know, thing. You want this match to be the hottest no later than Raw. You want it, like, you know, the Raw beforehand, you want it to be, that's when you want people to, like, tune in. Because, I mean, the SmackDown, you just kind of, like, say, okay, yeah, we, you know, the final few words, but you want it to be the hottest, like two shows before the actual event. And you got basically 1-2, then you're at your hottest, then one more show, and then you have the pay-per-view. So if they can do that, then yeah, this is gonna be an awesome moment for Drew. But, you know, again, the Karrion Kross thing, I don't know. I mean, that is, like I said, I like Karrion Kross. It's kind of like, if he's being set up for to be the next opponent, that's fine. If he's being set up to be a roadblock, that roadblock needs to be overcome on Monday.
Yeah. All right. Deep cleansing breath. We made it. Thank you for sticking
that was amazing,
Javier,
dude.
With us. Well thought out. You got to give him credit. Well thought out, well argued. Just really long.
Yeah, no,
and so.
coming from the same place I do, too, because, I mean, a lot of the stuff that he talked about in the soliloquy, you know, is basically a lot of the mentality of, you know, how I view a lot of things. But, yeah, that was impressive. And congratulations. I mean, there was one part there where you started losing it a little bit. I'm like, man, this guy so wants a drink of water right now.
It's hard. I'm back to school and I got sick in record time. So like my nose is literally running as we're talking, and you know, it's a mess.
Man.
I'm a mess right now. But before we let you go, go ahead and plug your work for the Torch and where fans can find you on social media, Javier.
Yeah, I just wrapped up my coverage of the G1. I did the coverage for, you know, all the block matches. I just wrapped it up, I think yesterday, with the finals, and also do the primers for AEW and the pay-per-view primers, or PLEs for AEW and WWE. And when I catch up to it, Impact, but somehow I like catch up to it, and then within like a week, I'm already 3 episodes behind.
I feel ya.
I had to give up on New Japan Strong because I'm like, yeah, something's got to give. If you want to follow me, I'm you probably know better than me, Jay Machado LK. On Twitter, and follow me. I'll follow you back. I'm easy follow because I never tweet anything. So,
if you want your Twitter feed clean as a sheet, follow Javier.
Yeah, so I'll give you a courtesy follow back. And if I get 100, I might actually tweet one thing out. 100 followers, so
wow.
I might tweet something out. So, you know, figure
there's
something
some incentive
out,
right
so,
there. There's
yeah.
Incentive to follow. All right, Javier, appreciate you joining me and sticking with me here a little over time. Good to talk to you, and we'll have you on again soon.
It's getting late, man. My tongue is beginning to fall asleep.
Yes.
thanks for having me, man. Have a good one.
All right, and thank you for joining us, of course. Next week will be our All Out and Clash of the Castle preview show. So a lot going on next week. Hope you email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com. Hope you tune in live next Sunday, 8 p.m. Eastern, pwtorchdailycast.com. I'm Greg Parks. You can find me on Twitter @GregMParks, and we'll talk to you next week, because if it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America.